Mystery Interview with Kitty Hawk Darrow on the 2nd of October 2003. The interviewer is Arnold Thackeray. And Kitty, the growth of the company, there were many facets to that, and one you haven't talked about was the advertising end. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that would be fun to talk about, because that was a lot of the pleasure. I think that we have mentioned, first of all, that we started out with a mailing list that was derived from the Rand McNally roadmap, where we took all the names of the towns, finally working down from 5,000 in population to the water treatment plant. Well, from this, obviously, it was necessary to have a mailing piece. Initially, the very first pieces were just mimeographed sheets with an instruction on how to carry out the test and the list of the chemicals necessary and their prices. Later on, we developed catalogs. But again, the catalogs carried the procedure. And we really found this to be a technique of promoting our form of chemistry. And then, of course, later on, as the company grew, and there was a big variety of catalogs, then we started writing catalogs for the various industries. So there would be something, for the municipal water treatment, for the waste treatment plant, for the user of industrial waters, boiler waters, boiler makeup water, I should say. And that, of course, required a mailing list. And so then, initially, we mailed everything to everybody on the mailing list. Soon, that was no longer practical. And we then began to put the mailing list into categories. In time, it became 250,000 names. But of course, this, again, there were many different categories because water is everywhere. And for example, there was a catalog for the fish farmer. And the farming of fish was something that has become, as people in the United States certainly have been very health conscious, and the need for fish, and fish farming became very popular, and they became good customers. And so we had catalogs for the fish farmer, for example. And I'll just tell a little bit of a story here that the Ralston Purina Company had what was called Kraut Chow. And it was stated initially that if you were raising trout, and if the temperature was correct, and the oxygen in the water was correct, and you did not overfeed the fish, you could produce a pound of flesh for a pound of food. And that was considered, at that time anyway, the most efficient producer of fish. And that's just another illustration of how we had a special niche. We had products for a special niche with a special catalog and a special mailing list.
That takes us right back to the farm girl raising turkeys.
No. I guess that's right.
that fish example that you used, what year approximately was Hart getting into a territory like that? Was that quite a late development of the?
Well, it was certainly a later development. But I think, came along with the concern about the quality of water and therefore fish that were raised in farms. They were monitoring the water better. So I would say it was late 78, 89, 80, long in there.
So,
and of course that industry has grown tremendously now.
How did an idea like that come in? Would that typically be Clifford, or would it be you, or would it be somebody outside saying?
No, that actually came from the field salesman. Initially was the raising of catfish in the South, and it was the salesmen in the South who were being approached by the catfish industry.
The salesman who would be selling to
Just the fact that they were in water analysis, and the catfish farmers realized they had a problem, and they would come to them the salesman actually brought the idea in, and of course Cliff really ran with it then. That came from the outside.
That you said water's everywhere, and this is a good example of everywhere, and of Hark getting known and the sort of snowball.
We were the one to come to because we were the ones that were, and of course we had the test kits and we had the easy test chemistry, and so they came to us.
And Clifford would typically respond to something like this, rather than it be a delegated.
Oh yes. Okay. Oh no. This was his forte. This is what he really he loved to do, this kind of thing. Yeah.
Go back to the mailing list for a minute. Who wrote the copy? Were you the writer?
Initially I wrote the copy. And however, as the company grew, we had a little advertising department, and then we even we had technically trained or graduate chemists who wrote copy.
Who hired the advertising department, as it were?
You have to understand in here, I'm getting very busy in a lot of ways, and once we were publicly held, there was a lot more financial matters, but advertising was something we had from the very beginning, and when we really started getting formally educated people, I would say that was later on. That was certainly by the early 80s or late 70s. Mm-hmm. But that became a full-blown, in time, we even had our own photography department.
Mm-hmm. But if we're back in the 50s and 60s and the mailing list is growing, is it 3x5 cards? What is the mailing list?
Of course we became famous for our little color cards, and on one side was a four color reproduction of a test set, whether or not it was in a box or whether it was just glassware, Erlenmeyer flasks or whatever. It was on the color card, and then on the back side would be a brief description and the price, and then that mailed out. We had dozens of those cards. Every time we had a new test, we put out a new color card. And then when the catalog was written, that procedure would get expanded, and it would know. But now the photography in the initial stage was a photographer in Ames, Iowa, who was very cooperative with us, and he really turned out to be very good with that. And we would take out all of our chemistry, set it up, and he had all the lights and all the cameras, and he would take the pictures. And of course, initially it was all in black and white. Later on, then of course it came into color, and then the color cards, because as that mailing list grew, we became a good customer of the color card industry, who at that time was really working hotels and resorts and you know, that kind of thing. And so we had a wonderfully cooperative color card manufacturer, and that was four color, glossy, and since of course we were taking thousands of them at that time, we weren't up to a quarter of a million by any means, but we were taking thousands. The price was right, and we put on the postage, and out they went.
When you say we took things to a photographer, was this you in the first instance?
Initially it was.
And this was your world rather than Clifford's to do that, or how did that?
Well, Cliff would lay out what he wanted done, but I cannot remember that Clifford ever was over at the photographer.
What about the literal design, the literal aesthetics of the design of these things? Was that who signed off on it? Was it you?
Well, I don't want to take all the credit for that. You know, actually, the photographer was good, and he had a real artistic eye. I really would rather give credit to him that he could set things up in a way so that everything was visible and presented, graphically pleasing.
What about how the mailing list was kept as you begin to get 1,000 names?
Well, initially we had them on old addressograph, multigraph cards. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, where you pounded them out. Well, of course, along came the computer. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't long until all of that was antiquated. But however, that's how far back we went. And in getting mailing lists easy to use, that's what I'm trying to say, easy to use. And but of course, we started when we got that IBM 632. By that time, we were already starting to put mailing lists on IBM, and so that.
And how did you grow the mailing list in the early days?
Every time you had a new customer, you had a new name to add. And we picked everybody that wasn't on when they ordered from us, they got on. Now you're going to ask, did we buy mailing lists? I think we tried once or twice. We found that those to be quite inaccurate, and so actually it was our customers. You know, we were kind of a learn about it from someone else kind of thing. It was that which is an awfully good way for advertising, is to have word of mouth. That's right. And but if you ordered, you were on the mailing list. And of course, as I have mentioned earlier, we got them later on into the categories, and then really got them segregated well. And then the advertising then was for that specific segment, and then we weren't duplicating advertising costs and I would say we really became quite sophisticated at that. And of course, with the computer, that's duck soup.
Yes. We're now going to talk a little bit about alterations in the text, and on page 6, the date of Clifford's graduation needs changing.
It says my mother lived till 1993. It was more like 1975. It's not 1993.
Okay. So we'll say 1975.
Yes, that's close enough.
Kitty, could you say a little bit more about how Clifford took on this first business venture from Harvey Deal?
Yes. Dr. Deal and his a fellow chemistry professor from Michigan had the Standard Sample Company. As two college professors, they recognized that there was a real need for the chemistry professor to have prepared samples, pre-analyzed, that were accurate, and provided with a code sheet in order to take some of the burden off for the teaching of quantitative analysis. I think that the fact that Dr. Deal was in Ames, Iowa, Dr. Frederick was up in Detroit, that while they had this idea, just distance prevented it from really growing. And I think Detroit professor was anxious to get out of the business. And so this was an opportunity that Clifford bought him out, and then that put Dr. Deal and Clifford then into the Standard Sample business.
And was Dr. Deal actively participating? Was it an active cooperation initially, or was Clifford, as the junior person, really doing all the work?
Absolutely. The analysis work was really what Clifford was doing. And then in the background, I was trying to do the advertising, preparing the code sheets, and all of that, and the mailing list to go out to all the professors of analytical chemistry. So that was, again, the building of a mailing list for a segment.
Looking back, this did give you the experience with mailing lists and advertising, though my sense is it was a pretty unhappy partnership.
Yes. Well, Harvey Deal was a very demanding, I would say a rather difficult person. He was a very bright man, and he was very prolific in his writings. He wrote the chemistry texts that I think are even used yet today. So he was, but as a business partner, he was kind of a difficult person, and there was a falling out between Harvey and Clifford, but in time and later on, they made up. And it became a nice, friendly relationship.
How did the chronology work? That is, Clifford and you are doing the standard samples. The water softening possibility comes along and is running side by side with this for a time.
That is correct.
And so that there's simultaneously a partnership with Harvey Deal and a new independent venture growing.
Yes.
And then the partnership with Harvey Deal is dissolved at what year approximately?
Well, it was a buyout.
Yes.
The
decision for the buyout was when?
Let me see. About 1949. Mm-hmm. Very, very early on. I think Dr. Deal there was a touchy. I touched on the fact that when that Clifford had made that tetraphenylarsenium chloride and had the bad fire. And I think Dr. Deal really wanted to separate himself from Clifford. And so I believe that it was Dr. Deal who asked to be bought out. And so that this was done over a period of time. And a price was established. Anymore, I honestly don't remember the number.
Yeah.
But then we took over then the Standard Sample Company and of course in this very fledgling water analysis business to get started.
And the money for the buyout over time was going to come out of the profits of the water business and the standard sample business, or what was your business?
Yeah.
Or was it still from the patent money?
I think the 15,000, I think by that time the money was gone, and so it really had to come from the growth of the company. Now,
so this is a very it seems to me this is a very testing moment. You've got two small children.
Yeah, turn it off at this point.
Kitty, every startup venture in the nature of the case is plagued by financial challenges. Can you talk about how Hark really got going over time from the financial point of view, beginning at the beginning?
Yes. I'll make a first statement that I would say that we bought the company three different times, and it was something like this. Initially, we bought out Dr. Diehl's partner, Dr. Frederick, and the money for that came from the initial $15,000 minus the taxes and minus the money that had already been spent. But anyway, that was the source of paying off, paying for half of the Standard Sample Company and getting the Hawk Chemical and Oxygen Company started. Then, after that was done, then the partnership was with Dr. Diehl, and during a period, Dr. Diehl felt that he really wanted out of the company, and so there was, we said we would buy Dr. Diehl out. Now, by this time, we really didn't have money, and so he was very patient with us, and this was over a payout from the earnings that were coming from this little fledgling water analysis business. And then...
That agreement and payout with Harvey Diehl, the agreement for that was made approximately when?
Oh, I would say about 1949. And then the company then began to show some signs of some growth, but we were not earning that kind of money, and we had the vision, we thought we could see what was out there, but we were out of money. And there was another chemistry professor at Iowa State who had industrial experience, and this was Dr. Charles Goetz. And Dr. Goetz had come to Iowa State from the Cardox Corporation. And I think that Dr. Goetz was somewhat well-to-do. Well, he saw this as an opportunity to invest some money. So he agreed to loan us $2,000, which was something that really there was no other place that we could have gotten money. But I think he saw in Clifford an innovative person, that we were two people who were willing to work hard. I'd like to say that he saw us as honest people, and so he loaned us then the $2,000. However, with that, he got 50% of the company, and we did have to return the $2,000. However, it was a godsend. It was something that we couldn't have gotten anywhere else, and so we accepted it. And then later on, then as the company grew, it was time to buy Dr. Goetz out, and then that arrangement was worked out through Mr. Arthur Luck, the president of the Union Story Trust and Savings Bank, and the bank did not loan the money to pay out Dr. Goetz, but Mr. Lucht went as the
honest broker.
The
honest broker.
Okay, the honest broker. I'm missing the word that I want here, but he was the mediator, and saw to it that the payments were made on time. And in fact, he did really very well for Dr. Goetz, and he invested the payments in the General Electric stock. So I think it worked out very nicely for Dr. Goetz, but it also then freed us up, and that was really the foundation of the Hawk Chemical Company as a standing entity.
The $2,000 loan was approximately when?
Well, I would say that it was about 1950 or 51, some 50.
And the agreement
like
to buy him out was much later?
Well, it came shortly after that. It was really rather early on to buying Dr. Getz out.
Shortly being what? Two or 3 years?
About 2 years and 2 years time that we started buying him out.
And these were years when you had, what, two or three young children?
Two at that
moment, and so
yes.
The $2,000 had to cover a lot of different things.
Yes. Now then, in all of...
Were you guys drawing a salary?
I didn't draw a salary for several years,
yes.
And Cliff did.
Of how much in the early stages, do you recall?
Well, it seemed to me like it was about like $50 a week. Something like that. Later on, after we had put this, the company had kind of started getting going, and then in all fairness to my mother and father, I would like to say, we had put an addition onto the first three rooms, and in that there was enough space that we could make a little apartment. And my mother and father gave us, they didn't loan us, they gave us some money, no way could we have paid it back, to finish this area out and to make it into a two-bedroom apartment. And so that was the beginning of the living in the plant.
Which was also another economical device.
Oh, yes. Well, it also meant that we could work every night. And that's exactly right. We worked there and weekends. Oh, you know, we would go to church and go by and pick up the mail and open the mail on the way home from church. Oh, dear.
The buyout of Dr. Getz was for how much? His half of the company.
I tell you, now I really need to check on dates on this. I can remember sitting in that room when I think our sales were up to something like $350,000 by that time. And I think I remember him saying, I can visualize that this company someday will have sales of $700,000. That's a number that is really pretty crystal clear in my mind. Now, how much he paid? Boy. I don't know. I thought it was somewhere around $350,000. I thought it was kind of like a dollar sales for a dollar of buyout.
So he was incredibly well rewarded from your hard work.
Well, he might not have felt so because the success of the company really came afterwards, but I think for what he put into it, I would say yes, that he was more than adequately paid.
Even by the standards of today's venture capitalists.
Yes, I guess so.
Kitty, the experience of having Dr. Goetz as the financial backer was obviously difficult and painful in some ways, but what positive learning came out of that experience?
Oh, I think that's a very fine question, Dr. Thackeray, and I'd like to address it. Dr. Goetz was a disciplinarian, and we had a little board meeting with Dr. Frederick Duke, Dr. Goetz, Clifford, and myself every Monday night. We went through the orders we had received, the orders that we had shipped, the bank balance, the accounts receivable balance. We had a complete review every Monday night of everything that went on. And I have no doubt but what that discipline is a part of what carried over as after the process of buying Dr. Goetz and Dr. Duke, who was a friend of Dr. Goetz's, out, and that financial discipline that we got started at that time carried on. We always knew at the end of every day, we knew exactly how many orders had been entered, what the total dollar volume was, and what had been shipped, and where we stood. And that carried through the entire time that we were with the company up until it was sold in 1999. And furthermore, that information was always shared with everybody. Everybody knew. We put it up on the wall so that all of the, even when we just had 10 employees, people knew where we stood with regard to what had come in and what had been shipped out and what remained to be shipped. We were always, so I would give Dr. Goetz the credit for starting that discipline that we learned at his foot and carried out.
So can you draw any moral out of all of this for someone contemplating a startup?
Well, today money is so much easier, generally speaking, is so much easier to come by. You know, I think today, well, first of all, I think it would be very hard to start a chemical company today, first of all, to even find a location, because it's not in my backyard. I think it would be hard to do that. I see all these venture capitalists and how they work, and I realize that we could have had more money. Perhaps we could have grown a lot faster and a lot larger, and we could have made some acquisitions that we would have liked to have done. But I'm not sure that we had all the... In those early days, you know, we were not business trained. We sort of learned on the job. And we didn't have MBAs and all the things that have come about. So I think maybe one way we did about the best we could with the kind of money that was available to us and using the kind of experience that we had.
Did you, just going forward, Kitty, when the company began to generate positive cash flow, did the territory of acquisitions ever seem appealing to you? My sense is the company grew by internal growth, self-financing, and was it's a very remarkable and self-contained story. is that?
That is exactly correct. To use a terminology that we hear today, it was all organic growth. It was all growth from within. There were some smaller companies that were kind of startups like we were, but here again, I think they were kind of young entrepreneurs, and I don't think anybody really wanted to sell out, and so the acquisition mentality had not matured at that time. And actually, we had our hands full financing our own internal growth, and so trying to take on something else really was not. I think we were smart enough to know we had our plate full.
Was there ever a time in the 1970s where you and Clifford really thought about selling the company? Was that ever a
Oh, we were approached all the time.
Yes.
Were you
tempted, let's put it that way, or what was the nature of the thinking of the two of you?
Yeah, well, there were some times when I could see that, gee, we can't get any money out of this company, and the only way we're going to be able to get it out is to sell it. And so we did talk to some people, but it was always came back to the same thing that Cliff so loved the company that I think he couldn't have thought of really parting with it. And so discussions always went nowhere. Yeah, no, there were some really very interesting approaches. And as I look back on them, I don't think they really would have been very successful for the kind of company we were. I can talk.